Thank you very much. John Williams.
Wow. Ladies and gentlemen, Teddy Roosevelt.
By Godfrey.
Mr. Roosevelt, welcome back to the College of DuPage.
I am delighted to be here. I don't know about you, but I feel as fit as a bull moose.
You look great.
A pleasure to see you, sir.
Yeah, no kidding. And you all got your constitutions, right? Read these and follow up. Everybody gets one, so there's one for you, too, sir.
Let me just say, and I mean no disrespect, but the Constitution exists for the people and not the people for the Constitution. The people are first, and if the Constitution does not enable them to make the progress that they need to make in the world, well, we'll just have to do without it.
No.
Yes, I said, and I hope you'll agree with me, it would be so much easier to govern this country without Congress. Yes! I called the Senate a concatenation of shrill eunuchs. And that's the more responsible branch of our government.
Yeah, it gets worse. You are an author. You are a
37 books.
A conservationist, an explorer, historian, naturalist. You rose to rank of colonel. You were a soldier, state representative. You were a governor. You were the Secretary of the Navy, the Vice President, the President. They even named a river after you.
The River of Doubt in the Amazon. In the Amazon Basin, I went after the debacle of the 1912 Bull Moose campaign, in which I challenged Taft for the nomination. They rigged the nomination in the Republican Party. This was the first year of presidential primaries in 13 states. First ever. And if the people had been allowed to decide, I would certainly have been the Republican nominee, but Taft, who was the incumbent, maneuvered things with what you would call super delegates, and he won the nomination. So this was in Chicago, and I went across the city, and I formed the Progressive or Bull Moose Party. And I said, we stand at Armageddon, and we battle for the Lord. Well, I lost that election. I stood as a third-party candidate. You know, I got 27% of the vote, the largest third-party vote in the history of this country. But it still was not enough to defeat Wilson, this pathetic little professor. We can talk about him later. But in the aftermath of that, I went to South America on a speaking tour. I was just going to do some moderately interesting hunting and so on. And when I got to Brazil, the Minister of Education met our boat and said, Mr. Roosevelt, there is a man named Candido Rondon who is about to explore the last uncharted tributary of the Amazon, the River of Doubt, and if you wished, you could join him as a full co-commander. So what was going to be a moderately interesting little South American hunting trip suddenly turned into one of the great adventures of my life. When I was asked if I wanted to do it, I said, it's my last chance to be a boy. But on that journey, I nearly died. I got jungle fevers and malaria, and an old wound in my leg reopened, and it was beginning to gangrene. And I felt certain that I would not come out of that adventure. In fact, I wanted to be left behind, and we'll talk about that later. But when I came back, I had lost 58 pounds, a quarter of my body mass, and I never fully recovered. But the good news is, they renamed the River of Doubt the Rio Roosevelt in my honor.
That's not what I was going to ask about.
I love to talk. You know, my wife Edith. My wife Edith, at dinner parties, I would have dinner parties in the White House, and I would invite luminaries, Henry Adams and John Wesley Powell, and all these extraordinary people who had done great things all over the world. And then in the middle of the dinner party, I would be holding forth and talking about this or that. And I would look over, and there was Edith, my wife. I don't know if any of you are married, but she would give me the look. The look that says, "You've gone on a little too long, Theodore." I couldn't stand that look. And I would say, "Edie, I'm just about finished here. Just give me one more minute. And so I will regard you as the moral equivalent of Edith."
They need an Edith. I just wanted to mention that you have been in our minds, maybe more ways than you even know. There's an article in the San Diego Union just the other day that compared you to one of the presidential candidates. You notice he said rigged, and you all started to laugh, and he said that the pathetic little professor had little hands. I think he said that, and so I think we would all be better off if we didn't keep score for the next hour or so. Let's just let him tell his stories here. But you've been on our minds because at the Democratic National Convention, President Obama, in introducing or talking about Hillary Clinton, described her as the man in the arena. And that's your speech, right?
After the safari in Africa, I went on a grand tour of Europe and gave talks here and there. I went to Norway to accept the Nobel Peace Prize, which I had won in 1906 for intervening successfully in the Russo-Japanese War. And I gave lectures at Oxford and Cambridge and so on. I got to review German-Prussian troops with the Kaiser, something that had never been afforded another national person before. But at the Sorbonne in October of 1910, I gave a speech on citizenship, ideal citizenship. And I there uttered what I suppose is my most famous speech. And I understand your president gave a few phrases from it not so long ago. This is what I said. "It is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbled or how the doer of deeds might have done them better. No, the credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred with dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs and goes wrong again and again, for there is no effort without error and shortcoming, but who does actually strive to do the deeds, who knows the great devotions, the great enthusiasms, and spends himself wholly in a noble cause. And if he should succeed, knows the glory of high achievement. But if he should fail, at least fails while daring greatly, and is not to be numbered amongst those cold and timid souls who know neither victory nor defeat. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena." That's my philosophy of life.
Yeah, boy, that's, I could.
Yes. The critics stand on the outside and they're always looking in and they're righteous and everyone should have, they attacked Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln was the greatest president in American history. I know he's your favorite son here. He was always scrutinized and condemned by the righteous. The abolitionists thought that he was lukewarm, that he wasn't sufficiently on board with their agenda. They condemned him for temporizing and for compromising. But Abraham Lincoln did more for the Negro than any human being who has ever lived on earth, because he was in the arena and he knew what it took to get the Emancipation Proclamation accepted by the American people. People who are outside the arena can talk all they wish because they have never been blooded. You must get into that dust and know defeat if you want to change the world.
Yeah, no kidding. We're so quick to criticize these days, and I think we should remember that. I want to talk a little bit about your life, but you know, you've come on like Roosevelt here, of course, and I really wonder, we're just less than 100 days from the next election. What should we think about in a president? What kind of person should they be? Talk a little bit about that.
Well, you want somebody who tells you the truth, even when you don't wish to hear the truth. You know, the source of my political power was that I said what I meant. And I meant what I said, and I didn't mince words. I told the people what I thought were the right policies for this country. I often told them that I thought they were wrong in this or that way. They didn't always agree with me, but they knew that I was a man of veracity and integrity, and they needed to be able to measure their political candidates so that once we were in office, we might possibly do the things we had said we were going to do. So the number one thing is a commitment to truth, a candor, and a willingness to talk about hard issues in an intelligent and forceful way.
Yeah. You were so committed to the truth that a newspaper once said that you were a drunk, and you said you weren't drunk. So what, they sued you or you sued them?
During the 1912 campaign, a newspaper in Michigan said that it was well known that in public I was frequently intoxicated. Well, the fact is that I was never really intoxicated in the whole course of my life, certainly not after Harvard, where I was a student. This really upset me. It's one thing to be called a jingo or a warmonger or a bully or whatever one might want to say, but when they accuse you of something that is demonstrably untrue, that offended me, and I wanted to set the record straight for history so that this would never come up by biographers. I'm a sarsaparilla man myself, and I therefore sued this editor, a man named Newitt, and we had a trial that lasted for more than a week in Michigan, and I demanded to be placed on the witness stand. And there I gave an autobiography of every alcoholic drink that I had ever consumed. It took about 3 hours. And I was, there was a mint julep there. And I drank some champagne on such and such an occasion. And finally the judge said, "Mr. Roosevelt, it is clear that you have been libeled. I am going to decide for you. I wish you would desist this long monologue." But I insisted upon completing it, and at the end he said, "I find for you, now you are entitled to damages. What would you like?" I said, "What's the statistical minimum here?" And he said, "6 cents. I said, "That's what I want." And so I was awarded 6 pennies. The trial cost me $40,000 to adjudicate. But I had proved to the world once and for all that whatever, one of the people that came, I brought in a whole celebrity list of people to speak to my character. And one of my closest friends on the witness stand said, "He only seems drunk."
Let's go through your childhood. We'll get them to the presidency, and we'll let you ask some questions too.
Yes.
You were, it's hard to believe, but a sickly child.
I was born in 1858, October 27th, in New York City. I had childhood asthma of a very severe sort, the kind that is life-threatening. In fact, family physicians told my father, "Thee, that your son probably will not live to be an adult." There was no remedy for asthma in those days. You suffocate. I remember having these episodes late at night. They usually occur deep into the night. My father would come in and he would rub my back vigorously. Sometimes he would get the carriage and we would go through the cobbled streets of New York at a breakneck speed to try to force oxygen into my decrepit lungs. Nothing seemed to help, and one summer when I was 12, I had really ruined everything for my family. When you have a child like this, the whole family has to sort of gravitate about his malady. And my father realized that this was in some danger of hurting my life, and he took me aside. My father, Theodore Roosevelt Sr., the greatest man I ever knew, and the only man I ever feared. And he took me aside and he said, "Theodore, your mind is strong, but your body is weak." He said, "My son, you will never achieve your potential if your body lags behind your spirit." He said, "I'm going to challenge you today. Son, you must make your body." Do you know what I said? I looked up at him and I said, "I will, Papa. I will make my body." And he bought me a home gymnasium kit. And I began to do jumping jacks and sit-ups and push-ups and lift a barbell or two. And I even learned a little of the science of pugilism. And by sheer force of will and desire to please my father, I lifted myself out of decrepitude into something like virility. Even at Harvard, where I graduated magna cum laude, my attendant physician said, "Mr. Roosevelt, you have a weak heart and a poor constitution. You should not expect to live very long." He said, "In the few months or years that you have remaining, I would urge you to lead an entirely sedentary life." I said to him, "Doctor, that is not the Roosevelt way." He said, I urge you never, for example, to bound up a flight of stairs." I said, "I'm going to bound up every flight of stairs I ever come to, because I would rather die on those stairs than be some sort of pathetic man in a chair." And so I eventually became, really through strenuous power of will and exercise, the spectacular specimen you see before you today.
You were home educated because you were so ill they didn't think you could go to school.
I never went to school, except to Harvard.
And at Harvard, you did well, you prospered.
Up to a point, I wasn't top of my class. I really object to some of the ways that science was being taught at Harvard at the time. I don't know if this would make any sense to you, but I was a bit of a trial to some of my professors. I remember one of them, he would be talking about science, and I would raise my hand and correct him or add some other information. He finally said, "Look, Roosevelt, I'm teaching this class." But I got through with summa cum laude, so I did quite well after all.
Summa cum laude at Harvard?
At Harvard, yes.
You were elected to the legislature in New York?
The youngest person ever elected to the New York State Assembly. I said I rose like a rocket.
You became a police commissioner in that state?
I was the New York City police commissioner for 3 years, at a time when we were really transforming our urban police forces from a motley crew of constables into something like a scientific cadre of real policemen. And I was able to bring typewriters into the force. There was a bicycle squad, the first use of fingerprints and other detective devices. For the first time, standardized revolvers. Up till that time, there was just a variety of guns. I wanted standardized weapons and training for every cop.
That time you fell in love and got married?
I have a hard time with this because I don't know if you know this, but I was married twice. And my first wife, whose name I will not mention, was an extraordinary woman, beautiful, literate, delicate. We were married on my birthday in 1880. She became pregnant. On February 12th, 1884, she gave birth to our first child. I received congratulatory telegrams up in Albany. But soon a second telegram came saying, "You must return to the city immediately. Your wife has taken a bad turn." And so I took the train down along the Hudson to Manhattan. There was fog. It took forever. When I got to our brownstone in the city, my brother Elliot answered the door. And he said, "Theodore, there is a curse on this house. For you see, my little darling wife was dying of Bright's disease, a total collapse of her kidney function. She was 23 years old. And at the same time, in the same house, my mother, Mitty, was dying. My mother was 49 and she had typhus. My wife was just in bloom as a young woman and bride. And she had Bright's disease, and I sat by my mother and held her hand, and she died in the middle of the night. Then I went down and I held Alice in my arms, and she died too. In short, the two most important women in my life died simultaneously on Valentine's Day, 1884. I had a little 2-inch by 3-inch diary that I was keeping, and I put a broad X in it, and I said, the light has gone out of my life. So I never mentioned her again. In my autobiography, I didn't mention her at all. The daughter, of course, went on to be the famous, the notorious, the infamous Alice Roosevelt Longworth. I wouldn't call her Alice. I called her sister or baby Lee. And so I don't talk about that because the pain is something you do not finally overcome. You just let the scar sit there.
So is that then why you went out west?
I had been going out west. I went out west for the first time in September of 1883, and I went there to kill a buffalo. At one time, there had been 50 or 60 million buffalo in America. They were as thick as locusts. But because of U.S. government policy and the railroads and butchery and so on and so forth, their numbers had been reduced to the brink of extinction. And now, by best estimates, in 1883, there were about perhaps 2,000 left in the world. 60 million to 2,000 straggled critters. We all reckoned that they would go extinct. And all I could think of is, I want to get mine first. And so I went out on the railroad, the Northern Pacific, out to the bad lands of Western Dakota Territory, and I got my buffalo. It's a fascinating story, and you can still see the head of it in the north room at Sagamore Hill. It was the first of a number of bison that I eventually killed. And by the way, I know you have some sentimentalists in the audience. I went on to save the buffalo with the Boone and Crockett Club, and now they are in no danger thanks to those conservation efforts, so please don't fall into righteousness. Yes, the best conservationists are hunters because they want to perpetuate the capacity to hunt. And so they preserve these species so their sons and grandsons and great-grandsons can have the same thrill that I had. And we saved the bison because of it. It's a wonderful story about a man named William Hornaday, but that's another topic. So I went out there to get the buffalo, and while I was there, I fell in love with the Badlands. They reminded me in their buttes and bluffs and coulees and the striations and the weird shapes and the hoodoos and so on. It somehow reminded me of the poetry of Edgar Allan Poe. And so impulsively, I invested first in one ranch, the Maltese Cross. That was 1883. And then the next year, after the death of my mother and my first wife, I invested in a second ranch, a remote one called the Elkhorn. And that became my headquarters. And it was there that I grieved. And do you know that at this time, in June and July of 1884, I actually thought I would never return to the East, that my life in the East was done, that I would make my future in the West, and maybe if North Dakota became a state, I could be the governor, perhaps, or something local, but I would be a cowboy. I think I heard some amusement. Who laughed? I will repeat, and I am looking very carefully now, and I am not amused. I became a cowboy and a rancher. You know, later in life, in 1904, when I was president, Albert Fall of New Mexico came to see me in the White House, and I said to him this, I'll ask you this question, John. If you could preserve just one memory of all of the memories of your life, but everything else would disappear forever and could never be reclaimed. Mm-hmm. And it can't be your children or your marriage.
Okay.
One memory and one memory only of all of the memories of your life, what would it be? Without waiting to hear Senator Fall answer, I said, it's clear to me that the experience that I would live again and again to the exclusion of all others is my time as an authentic rancher and cowboy out on the plains of Dakota. That was the moment of my life. How about you, sir?
Boy, there's a lot of wrong answers, you know. I'm thinking, well, I don't want to diss or forget anybody, so I don't have a fast answer. All mine are my children, my wife, my family.
Now, maybe it's time for a little adventure. You know, when I look at you, I see a handsome man and a learned man and a witty man, but I don't see a manly man.
Please don't clap.
I see shoulders that look like a champagne bottle. You need to get out and do something. You need to climb something, to build something, shoot something. You think I'm joking. This is not this man, but this phenomenon is what is wrong with America. We are a frontier nation. Daniel Boone and Davy Crockett and George Rogers Clark and Meriwether Lewis and so on. They made this country. You should know this in Chicago. You were out on the far frontier. And those energies of proving up the forest, cutting down trees, plowing the land for the first time, removing the varmints, that's what made this country. In 1890, the U.S. Census Bureau declared that the frontier was closed, that there really wasn't any frontier left. The question was, now what? Are we going to become a sedentary, effeminate nation? Or will we find some way to continue this deep, heroic dynamism that made us the most extraordinary people who ever lived on Earth?
Some way to make America great again is what you're
thinking. Yes. But exactly. Exactly, because and I mean no disrespect to you, but the urban men going to the fashionable clubs, drinking too much, wenching, and living off inheritance, and contributing absolutely nothing to the nation, just a kind of decadent elite squad of privileged people. And these are the leaders of the country. This is no way to maintain those Davy Crockett energies. And so I went out to the Badlands to prove myself as a man. And I did become a man out there, and others can too. And that's why we have national parks, by the way. So that you can leave your... Yes! So that you can leave your citified life and go out and squat around a fire and eat beans and bacon and drink camp coffee and listen to the coyotes and look up at the stars. That's what renews us. They don't do that in Canada. That never happens in France. We alone are this people, and we must maintain this energy.
You had that even when you were the president of the United States. You would be boxing and wrestling and hiking and climbing as the sitting president of the United States, right?
I rode horses almost every day as president, and I did jujitsu. I'll tell you this. First of all, I did boxing. I told you I had learned it at Harvard. And I would box with naval lieutenants in the White House, and I would always say, don't hold back. You know, hit me, hit me. And one hit me in the left eye and tore the retina, and at that time, that was it. That eye never came back. I didn't tell him because I did not want to hurt his feelings. But then Edith, my wife, said, no more boxing. You've got one eye left. That's it on the boxing. So then I took up stick fighting. Now that is really interesting. What you do is you cover yourself with pillows and mattresses and take 2x4s and beat the living daylights out of each other. I would come back into the private area of the White House bruised and bleeding over all of my body and think, I've never had a better day than this. And then I took up jujitsu. And I said, there is nothing quite so exhilarating as being thrown over the neck of a 300-pound Japanese man. And we played point to point. Have you ever done that?
I've not played point to point.
Point to point, Rock Creek Park. Get cabinet ministers and maybe some diplomats and the Speaker of the House, some of my tennis cabinet. We'd go off and we'd wear old clothing for the most part. And then I'd say, do you see that barn there 2 miles away? We're going to walk to it point to point. Single file. We never deviate. If we come to a hay mound, we climb over it. We come to a house, we knock on the front door and go through the back. We come to a tree, we climb up over it, point to point. And if you deviate an inch, you're sent home. So we would swim through Rock Creek Park. You know, Rock Creek would sometimes be swollen with rains. I remember one time I had the diplomatic corps. And off we went, and we got to Rock Creek, and it was very full of water. And so I, in front of about 15 others, took off all my clothes and swam the river. And then I looked back and they were all standing there and kind of cowering and covering up and avoiding eye contact. And I said, let's go here. So reluctantly, one after the other took their clothes off and folded them up and swam. And finally, I looked over and there was the French ambassador, a man named Jules Jusserand. And he was just quivering and I said, you're in America now. And so finally, with the deepest sense of shame, he took off all of his clothes and he folded them with Gallic precision. And he put them on top of his head. And then he began to work his way through Rock Creek. But I noticed that even though he was naked as the day he was born, he still had his diplomatic gloves on. So nothing could cut a more comic effect than this man naked with his perfect bundle on his head and then his diplomatic gloves. And I said, whatever are you doing? Why would you wear your gloves? And he said, in case we meet ladies. Yes. Point to point. It develops character. I did it with my children, too.
And you did this as the President of the United States?
Yes.
Okay. Well, it's a good thing they didn't have cell phone video back then, right? Or that would end badly for you.
The point is, and there's a serious point here.
Yeah, what is that, by the way? What is it?
That the president is just another American. He's not some god. He's not some dictator. No. When I left the presidency voluntarily in early 1909, I said, I promise the American people that there has not been another family that has enjoyed living in this house so much as we have. And there is not another president who has enjoyed being your president as much as I have. I always said, John, I'm not the smartest man, the bravest man. I'm an average American with enormous energy. That's the point. I'm an average American. So people could relate to me. People always said, what's the source of your power, Mr. President? I said, well, number one, I'm a war hero. That doesn't hurt. San Juan Hill, 1898, July 1st. My crowded hour. If you have a chance to fight for this country and you duck it, don't run for office. If you're president, you might have to do the most melancholy thing that any president ever does. You might have to take your children or your grandchildren and send them into harm's way. Think of the gravity of that. Think of Lincoln having to do that. And if you had a chance to fight during your lifetime and you didn't, you do not deserve the respect of the American people. So number one, I was a war hero. Number two, I was an authentic cowboy.
You don't look like an authentic cowboy, that's all. It's just...
Let me tell you a story. Do we have time for a story?
We're going to take questions in a moment, but it's your stage, sir.
I was there out in Dakota for about 4 years, off and on. And I did everything. I stopped stampedes. I pulled horses and individuals out of quicksand. I arrested boat thieves and took them to justice in Dickinson in Dakota Territory. I punched out a ruffian, a gunslinger in a bar. But one day, I was in a roundup. You think, oh, you're not a cowboy. And in the roundup, we would work for a month, maybe 5 weeks, and we'd move down slowly and pull all the calves out of the hills, and then we would brand them according to the mother that they were suckling on. This was very difficult business. I'm not the greatest ropist, but I was strong, and I had stamina, and I never shirked the most difficult duty. So my job was to be here in the middle, and the cowboy would rope the hooves of the calf and drag it in here, and then I would lean on it with all of my might, and someone would come up and clip off its testicles, and somebody else would take a hot brand into its flank. Now you can imagine that the calf is not enjoying these operations whatsoever, and it's kicking and screaming and trying to hurt the person who's holding him. Exhausting work. I did it hour after hour, and finally, if the calves get out of this circle, it is so hard to get them back again. And there was this young cowboy who, you know, he regarded himself as a kind of a ladies' man. And he was leaning up against the fence and striking poses in his spurs. And because of that, he missed one of the calves that squirted out. And without even thinking about it, I looked over at him and I said, "Hasten forward quickly there." I said, "Hasten forward quickly there." Well, they all laughed. And for the rest of my time in the Badlands of Dakota Territory, when I would meet these cow punchers on the streets, they'd say, "Oh, hasten forward, Colonel Roosevelt." And there was even a drink in one of the saloons called the Hasten Forward.
Hasten forward quickly there means get out of the way.
Mind to your business here.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, at Harvard, we speak in a certain fashion.
Yeah.
And when you're in Dakota, that doesn't translate.
It does not. It does not.
And they had to come to terms with what they regarded as affectation spectacles. They called me Four Eyes or Storm Windows or Shutters. And then you see when I get excited, my voice goes straight up. I'm excitable.
Yeah, well.
And I brushed my teeth out on the roundups when most people didn't have teeth. That sort of thing. And so and when I first went out there, I wanted so much to be accepted as authentic. And I made a mistake. I had a designer suit of buckskins made for myself. And those were the most beautiful buckskins you've ever seen. The fringe was absolutely level and perfect. And there wasn't a mosquito's blood on it anywhere. It was magnificent. And then I had a buckle of silver with scenes from the American West carved on it. And silver spurs, one with T and one with R. Alligator boots. And then the piece de resistance was a Bowie knife hand carved by Tiffany's. And because of this, not everyone regarded me as fully authentic. Yes, they called me dude. But I showed them through grit. And you know what? Laugh if you like. But because I loved them, respected them. No, they don't know Latin. They don't attend opera. They don't even read books. But they are outstanding in a crisis. Their word is their bond. They have strength that you cannot find in New York or Chicago or Boston or Philadelphia. And because I loved and respected them, they slowly came to respect me, and they became the source of my political greatness. The reforms I attempted could never have been achieved by someone who didn't have that rapport with average Americans everywhere. And so that's the period in my life that transformed me from an elitist into a small D Democrat. Not a large D Democrat. No rational being would be a Democrat of that sort.
We'll let you ask some questions. We have microphones in both corners, up and down. They're right over here so that the microphones can pick it up. Just make your way over there if you like. You can raise your hand, but I will hear you better if you just make your way over there. And while they're getting in position... This show to me is also about leadership. This show doesn't happen, but a guy named Jimmy DeCastro and Todd Manley, my bosses at WGN Radio, we're still behind it, even though I'm only on the radio on Saturdays. And I so appreciate your listening if you do that and do our podcast. But really, this whole team comes together because I think at WGN we really have great leadership. One of my first great bosses, a friend of mine named David McCauley, is here. Is that you right there? David is here somewhere, and I'm glad that he's here because he was a great leader and mentor to me too. And I think that's what America needs. It's leadership, and we'll figure out who's going to lead us in the future. But America is also about commerce. And so while you get to the microphones, Condisec and Dillon are skilled and experienced litigation attorneys in the Chicago area. They're dedicated to helping you through difficult times.
I say every citizen needs a square deal.
Have you ever been injured before, sir?
I was, sir. I was hit by a cable car in 1902.
Wow, you could have used Condisec and Dillon.
I might have wanted to settle that by myself, but if I had, yes, of course. I was blinded in the eye by a punch.
You could have used Condisec and Dillon.
I was accused of being a drunk.
You could have used Condisec and Dillon. Condisec and Dillon, 630-262-9655. Thank you for that, sir.
My delight.
Who's over here? Yes, sir, you have a question.
Mr. President, it has been rumored in one edition of biographical background on you that you negotiated some agreements with the Japanese which may have influenced the start of the Second World War. What is your feeling on that?
Did my negotiations with the Japanese in 1906 and 1909 bring on the Second World War? Well, I died in 1919, and so I don't know for sure the dynamics that led to that conflict, but I say nonsense. The Japanese and the Russians were at odds in the Far East. The Japanese defeated the Russians in several extraordinary battles. This shocked the world because the Caucasian world regarded Asiatics as a diminutive race that would never be strong enough and so on and so forth. And the Japanese humbled the Russians. Now, this war was destabilizing the Pacific. I decided to intervene. And even though the United States was regarded by most European countries as an upstart and a frontier nation that was still inward looking, I offered to try to settle the war. And I brought the diplomats from Russia and from Japan to Portsmouth in New Hampshire, and I forced them to sit down, and they eventually worked it out, and there was an agreement. And for that, I won the Nobel Peace Prize. Now, I did say I was impressed by the Japanese. I said they are a rising nation. They're militant. They're in an imperial mood. There will probably be a reckoning between them and us in the Pacific at some point. But when that would come, I simply don't know. But to argue, as I know some have, that my diplomatic efforts either hastened or made inevitable the Second War is sheer nonsense. A president's duty is to try to keep the balance of power in the world peacefully if possible. and to intervene only when it is absolutely necessary, but then to do it, as I said, speak softly, but carry a big stick.
Mr. President, I've read various accounts of you taking a bullet. I think it was in Milwaukee, and they're conflicting. What is the truth of that?
The truth about the assassination attempt. It was the Bull Moose campaign of 1912. That was a very difficult time in my life. Taft had been my hand-picked successor. He proved to be a disaster. I challenged him reluctantly in 1912. I had pledged never to stand for a third term, and now here I was. I gave speeches all over this country, even though the great majority of the American people were behind me. The system just wouldn't make it possible for me to prevail. And so it was very frustrating, very damaging to me. I was exhausted, and I was in Milwaukee. It was October 14th, 1912, and my handlers wanted me to take a nap before a major address in the city auditorium, but the local host wanted me to come in to supper, so I did. And now we were running a bit late, so I decided to get into a jalopy and go off to the speech. And as I got into the back seat of this jalopy, a saloon owner by the name of John Schrank, who had been stalking me for weeks, shot me at point-blank range. He stepped off the curb, aimed a pistol at me, and shot me right in the chest. I said, he pinked me, and I slumped in the seat. Well, fortunately, I had a steel spectacles case and my 50-page speech wadded up. And together they slowed the trajectory of the bullet, which lodged in my rib but did not kill me. I'm an old big game hunter, so I coughed some spittle into my hand, and when there was no blood in it, I said, it is by no means a mortal wound. But I was bleeding blood all over the place. So my handler said, well, we will rush to the emergency room. I said, no. He said, I am going to give my speech as planned, even if it is the last speech of my life. And off we went to the auditorium, and I got up, and the crowd was there, much larger than this, and they were a little bit shocked because blood was shooting out of me. And I sort of clung to the podium a little bit, and I said, I just want to warn you that I may not be at full strength tonight. You see, I have just been assassinated. And then I gave an 84-minute speech. 84 minutes, and I handed out pieces of the speech as souvenirs to people because there were bullet holes in them. And finally, I was fainting dead away, and my handlers just insisted that we go away. And I came down, and here's the best part of it. As I came down the stairs, the crowd had lined up, 100 or 200 people, and they were shaking their hands as we left. And finally, one of my handlers said, you realize, of course, that each one wants to be the last person ever to hold your hand. And so off we went to the hospital, and when we got there, they brought out the gurney. I said, I am walking into this hospital if it is the last walk of my life, and I lived. I'm an old big game hunter and a soldier, and I regard someone who puts himself into this arena as someone who may fall, and we mustn't be sentimental about it. And I actually thought that the near assassination might be a political advantage in the election.
Get a little spike that week.
Right,
yeah,
a little
bump.
We call it a spike. And I did get a little spike, but not enough. And that little Woodrow Wilson. You know, I had traveled the world. I had been on safaris. I had lived in Dresden for a year to master German. I knew 5 languages. I had been on the Nile. I had been to the Vatican to meet popes. On my honeymoon, I climbed the Matterhorn. And Wilson, I am not exaggerating. When he became the President of the United States, his longest and only trip outside our borders had been to Scotland on a bicycle tour. That alone should unfit him for the presidency. a bicycle tour of Scotland. You must be joking. You know, when Taft was standing in my succession, he was my dear friend. You've been reading a book about this. Bully by this, yes. Dear friend, and he said to me, "Mr. Roosevelt, what's your advice to me?" I said, "I only have one piece of advice. Never be photographed golfing." I said, "Not only is golfing a sissy sport that no real man would ever engage in, but it's a rich man's hobby, and average people don't have the time or the money to golf. And so if you are photographed golfing, it pushes you outside their world. And if you want to be a leader in this country, you have to embrace the people and show them that you're essentially one of them." Well, he didn't listen.
Next question up here. Sarah, do we have a question up there? No, okay. And over here. Yes, sir, go right ahead.
Mr. President, as we speak, the Olympic Games are happening in Rio de Janeiro. I'm sorry, were you pointing up there?
No, keep going. We'll get
you. I'm so sorry.
You're doing fine.
But yeah, the Olympic Games are happening. And you are, as we all know, a fan of sport and athleticism and, as you have said, the strenuous life. Do you have a favorite Olympic sport? I know they've changed a lot since your time.
I will tell you honestly that the Olympics had begun in ancient Greece. They had been abandoned for millennia, and they were restored in the post-Civil War period and became something of a sort of a new attempt to create international harmony and so on. And I'm for sport of every sort, especially if it's sport involving a horse or a rifle. But I will say this, and I hope I don't offend any of you, but I think perhaps you make more than you should of these Olympics, and I feel very strongly about this, that no one should ever participate in the Olympics who is not a thoroughgoing amateur, period. There is no room for national professionalism in the Olympics. We want average boys and girls from this country. Not professionals, not people who are paid or specially trained or have squads of handlers. We want average people to compete honestly in these games, just as we want our young people to be in rodeos or county fairs. The professionalization of sport. You know, I saved college football. Yes, you know, college football, in my time, they did not have helmets, and there was no line of scrimmage, so it was a bit like rugby. And there were deaths. There were a number of deaths, I think 5 in 1 year when I began to be president. And Charles Eliot, the president of Harvard, wanted to abandon football altogether, to ban it as a collegiate sport. I like football. So I called in a blue ribbon commission and I said, "Fix it. Make it safer." And they developed the line of scrimmage, a cessation of hostilities between plays. That's what that is, really. Go watch some rugby and you'll see a cessation of hostilities between plays and helmets and certain rules. And that saved football, and that was the birth of the NCAA. I like manly sports, but they need to be amateur sports.
Got it. And now upstairs. Yes, sir, go right ahead.
Hello, Mr. President. For the last 25 years, I've been making trips to the Badlands of North Dakota for a week to chase deer and such. And I just wanted to let you know your Elkhorn Ranch site is just as beautiful today as it was when you were there.
Yeah. I'm glad to know that. You know, the Elkhorn was 35 miles deep into the Dakota wilderness. It was a very remote place. I was grieving for my wife and mother. And I had a second place that was close to the village of Medora, called it the Maltese Cross. But when I came back in June of 1884, I was so broken that I decided to find a remote place where I could just have solitude. And I rode down north on the Little Missouri River, and I met a man named Howard Eaton. And he said, there's a ranch, there's a there's an oxbow of the river over here underneath some bluffs. It's very remote and no one has claimed it. I think you'd find that very useful, Mr. Roosevelt. And I went there and I found the horns of two bull elk had locked in struggle, and the horns had gotten stuck, and so they'd both starved to death. And I said, this is the Elkhorn Ranch, because life is struggle, life is loss. Darwin was right, that it's a struggle to exist for humans too. And so I named it the Elkhorn, and I built a 30 by 60 foot cottonwood log house there, and that became my Dakota headquarters. And I wrote parts of three books there. I wrote 37 books altogether. That's more than any other president. Some of them are regarded as American classics. I wrote them by myself. No ghostwriters of any sort ever. And the next writingest president was John Quincy Adams, who wrote 12 books, and I'm happy to say all of them were unreadable.
By the way, you might be happy to know that in the Badlands, Mount Rushmore, you look great up there.
Now, Mount Rushmore is in South Dakota, not my beloved North Dakota.
There's a difference? We got two of them, all right. Sorry.
South Dakota has the Black Hills.
Right.
And there, after my time, Gutzon Borglum, who knew me, made me the fourth face there. I'll say this of Mount Rushmore. Of course, I never saw it. I rode past the mountain, but I never knew what was intended there. Of the four there, Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln, and myself, there's one and only one who was ever there. And I am he. Jefferson bought Louisiana, but Jefferson was a man wholly unfit for the presidency. If he had gone to Mount Rushmore, he would have had to take an entourage of wine and books and scientific instruments and linens. Imagine Jefferson behind a fire eating beans in the wilderness. If ever there was a man who was a coward.
Oh, please.
Yes!
Please.
He was a coward. When the British came, he fled to Carter's Mountain. And he disarmed this country, bringing on and making worse the War of 1812. Washington I revere, of course. And the greatest president, without question, is Abraham Lincoln. But I'm the only one who was ever in South Dakota. Hmm. That should count for something.
Okay. I think we're over here next. We'll kind of keep working around. Yeah, over here.
Good morning, Mr. President. During the course of your political career, you seemingly moved away from traditional Republican values and embraced progressivism. Progressive, a term that's being bandied about in our era. I wonder if you could explain a little bit of the beliefs and ideals of progressivism in your era and compare or perhaps contrast that with what we term as progressive today.
Well, let me say just this. I'll try to speak in a kind of an analytical voice. I began my life as a laissez-faire Republican. The less that we intrude in the economy, the better. But there was a bill in the New York State Assembly to prohibit the household manufacture of cigars. I voted against it because I believe in the sanctity of contract. If you want to roll cigars in your home, it's not my business. It's certainly not government's business. But a man named Samuel Gompers came to me and he said, Mr. Roosevelt, I want you to come with me to look at some of these tenement houses. And so I did it. And so he took me for 3 or 4 days to tenements in Manhattan. You walk up to the sixth floor. Get to the sixth floor, there's no elevator, the windows are sealed shut, there's no running water, there's no heat. 5, 10, 15, 20 immigrants living in one room, sharing the bed, sleeping all over the floor, children of 2 and 3 rolling cigars. Typhus, cholera, pneumonia, filth, vermin, fleas, rats. When you see how the other half lives, recent immigrants who don't even speak English, people who don't come from a nation of a constitutional background, no bills of rights, no rule of law, no due process. They come here because they believe in America, and suddenly they're swept into the great dynamics of our cities, and they have no way of earning a living, and they'll do anything. They'll sell their labor because they have to eat. When I saw this, the scabs and the children choking from the fumes of tobacco, 7, 8, 10 people to a bed, and the domestic abuse that comes with all of this, I realized that our government has to take a role, that the least self-reliant among us cannot protect themselves. Talk of free contract means nothing when you're starving. And so the only force large enough to be a counterweight to the cruelty of business, the willingness of business to use up people, that has to be government. I'd rather that it were not the case, but that has to be government. And so I found myself in a transformation. I'll just tell one quick other story about this. In 1906, I received a copy in the mail of Upton Sinclair's novel, The Jungle. Have you read it? Yeah. And he was talking about the great packing houses in Chicago. There was a disgusting novel that workers would get sucked into machines and your arm would wind up in sausage. And that there were no inspectors and the tainted meat would go into your food supply. And that mice and rats and fecal matter and whatever you can imagine was in your food. Now, we were no longer a farming nation, so people couldn't supply their own food. They lived in Philadelphia. They lived in Chicago. They needed meat in tins. So when I read that novel, I wrote to him. I immediately wrote him a letter, and I said, "Dear Mr. Sinclair, I've read your novel. I think it's probably the worst sort of muckraking. I'm sure you have exaggerated the conditions, but I'm going to look into it, and if you're right, I shall write to you again." So I called in the great meatpacking moguls, Swift and Armour and so on, and I said to them, "Is this true? Now, you can finish this story." They said, "Oh, no, these are anecdotes. This is some sort of a liberal man who hates America. Once in a while something like this may have occurred, but believe me, Mr. President, this is not routine." I said, "I'm going to give you 6 months to bring reforms of your industry to me." And I had a Blue Ribbon Commission look into it, and you know what? It was worse than Upton Sinclair's novel, The Jungle. So after 6 months, these great masters of industry came back to the White House, and they proposed toothless, symbolic, namby-pamby reforms that had no capacity to fix anything. This story sounding familiar to you? And I said, "Is this the best you can do?" And they said, "Of course, if we did more, it would bankrupt the business." How often have you heard that? And I said, "Gentlemen, if that is your best offer, you leave me no option but to release the Blue Ribbon Report." And I did so, and the American people were appalled. And they insisted that their congressmen and senators pass the Meat Inspection Act of 1906, and that changed the nature of our food supply. Do you see what I'm saying? That industry is important. We should honor people who are capitalists. We should admire what they have done. But we cannot let them rule the world, because they won't allow a single tree to stand in the West. They won't secure your food supply. They will not provide safety for their workers. This only comes when government says you must do minimal things for human happiness and security. That's important.
Let me ask you this.
Yes, sir.
Okay, so clap if you think today he would be a Democrat. Go.
Never! Never!
How many of you think he's a Republican today?
Thank you so much. I am a Republican because and you know this more than any other Americans, Abraham Lincoln of Illinois was a Republican, and the Republican Party at the time stood for racial justice for the plain people of this country, for the farmers and the laborers and the housewives. It was the party of the Constitution, and the Democrats at that time were the party of the bloody shirt. They were the secessionists and the slave mongers. And so I am always going to be a Republican. I would never, you could never convince me to be a Democrat, ever.
Yeah, well, I got news for you. They think you're a Democrat. times have changed a little bit. It was interesting, too, wasn't it, to see Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump's economic policies this week, because both of them want America to be great. They've got great ideas. One thinks the economy will grow more if we have less taxes, and the other one is more traditional Democrat, continue to make the taxes the way they are, lower the threshold of the inheritance tax, tax the rich, take that money in and make America great. I wonder where you would be on that continuum.
I'm not for taxing the rich. I respect what they've done. They're the engines of our national prosperity, the Carnegies and the Rockefellers and the Mellons and so on. We need them. They take the risk. They build the jobs. They build the plants. They're the ones who understand how the economy works, and they have created enormous wealth for this country.
See, he's a Republican.
We don't want to confiscate their wealth. I am only wanting to get at the malefactors of wealth, the people who bribe, who issue shoddy products, who exploit labor, who exploit foreign nationals who can't speak our language. I'm not for confiscations of the rich. That would be ruinous, but I'll tell you this. Ask yourself this. In an advanced urban industrial nation like yours, would a libertarian model protect the least protected and vulnerable of our citizens? In other words, this is what the square deal was all about. You know, if you play poker, if the dealer shuffles the cards and John gets a terrific hand and I get a mediocre one, that's nobody's fault. That's life. Not everyone is strong or beautiful or intelligent or creative or lucky. You can't determine how the cards are going to be dealt by the great shuffler. But if the dealer is favoring his cronies and misdirecting the shuffle, helping the most privileged of all Americans get more money and more power and more privilege, that's the problem. We need a square deal. If there's a square deal, people may be disappointed in their lives when they have nobody to blame. But if the system is rigged for the rich and the powerful, then the people will have a revolution of the French sort unless we reform these things from within. I'm a conservative reformist. I want to make a square deal for everyone, and then nobody will complain.
Up there.
Mr. President, towards the end of Wilson's term, your health was declining. You were grieving the loss of a son. Were you considering a run in 1920?
Yes, I would have run for the presidency in 1920, and I think I would have won, but my health had deteriorated after the South American trip. You know, we had no antibiotics in my time, and I had used my body ruinously through my entire life. I'd broken almost every bone, and I nearly died in the Amazon jungle, and I just wasn't very strong by 1918 any longer. I was overweight, and some of those jungle fevers never really left my system. And I was grieving for Quentin. You know, when World War I finally came, when Wilson finally got strong enough to do the right thing, I went to my four sons and said, "You are all going to war. You will not hold back. You will not accept desk jobs. You will not be protected. You are going to war. You are going to the front. And if you can, you're going to fight." And they all did, and they were all bloodied. And one of them, my youngest and my favorite, Quentin, died. He was an early aeronautalist. He was in a dogfight north of Paris, shot down by the Germans, and he died. And when we didn't have a very instantaneous communication system at the time, but I was at Sagamore Hill. I was in my study. Edith was doing something somewhere else in the house. Someone knocked on the door, and it was an Associated Press reporter, and he said, "Have you heard the news, Mr. Roosevelt? Something has happened to one of your sons." I said, "I have not heard the news. Please come back when you know more." I assumed it might be a rumor, so I said nothing to Edith. Later that day, he returned to confirm that Quentin had been shot down and was dead. I thanked him, went into my study, and was alone for 15 or 20 minutes, and then I came out. I said, "I must now do the most difficult thing that I've ever had to do in my whole life. I must go tell Edith." And off I went. And we grieved, of course. Our lives were never the same. When you bury your own child, your life is never the same. But I said, rather than that he should have lived as a coward or someone holding back, I would prefer that he had died. No man is fit to live who is not willing to die for his country. But we never recovered from that loss.
Take another couple questions before the show is over today. Right over there.
Mr. President, what did you think about Robin Williams' portrayal as you in the Night at the Museum series?
What do I think about the way that actors have portrayed me in films?
We've never got that question before, by the way.
I don't particularly like to be caricatured, but it strikes me that I am my own caricature. There's just a larger-than-life, somewhat comedic element to my adventures. I suppose there's a reason for this. When I was a child, I was an invalid, as you know, and I read deeply, and I read the romance novels of Fenimore Cooper and a man named Mayne Reid. And Reid wrote books like The White Buffalo Hunter and The Scout. And I gained a romance, particularly a romance for heroic adventure and hunting in the West, Indian fighting. That early reading stayed with me all of my life, and I became a kind of super exuberance of romance. And I suppose the way I tell stories and the quality of my personality is such that it feels a bit like a caricature. And so it's easy, I suppose, for filmmakers and others to present me in that light. I don't suppose they do that with Grover Cleveland or Millard Fillmore or Rutherford B. Hayes. And so the reason that people attend to me is because I was larger than life. And I'll remember this. When I went back campaigning for the vice presidency in 1900, we were going through what was now North Dakota and went to Fargo and to Valley City and to Jamestown and to Bismarck and to Dickinson. And it was 11 o'clock at night, and we were on our way to Billings. And my handler said, let's just go straight through Medora. There are no votes there. It's late at night. And I said, we are stopping in Medora. And so when we got there, we slowed the train, and I got out to the back of it and looked down, and there had gathered for hours my old friends. People who were infants when I was out there as a cowboy were now grown up, and I could recognize them. And their parents were weathered and wrinkled and gray and missing some teeth now. But they had come, and they were shy around me now. They had been bold with me when I was a young man, and now they were shy because they knew that I was a great figure now, a national figure. And so there was this beautiful, sweet shyness and deference in them. It was terribly moving to me to see them. This had been the formative moment of my life. And I remember looking out, and I said, it is here that the romance of my life began. It is here that the romance of my life began. And so when you have films and popular culture in your time that point to all of this, Shetland ponies going up into the White House elevators and cowboys and Indians being played in Albany and the governor's mansion and that sort of thing, we sort of lend ourselves to this sort of caricature.
You more than anybody.
You had a Shetland pony in the White House elevator?
Well, Archie had a Shetland pony and he was sick, and his younger brother Quentin thought maybe he would get better if he could see his Shetland pony. And so we had the first elevator in Washington, D.C., and Archie was astonished when Quentin brought his Shetland pony up on the White House elevator, and everyone thought it was an extremely interesting and capital story, except Edith.
You have a question.
Yes, hello, Mr. President. My question's going to actually combine two of your views. Your encouragement to Wilson, President Wilson, with regard to pressure Germany and intervention and looking ahead to stop problems before they arise. The world has grown small since you were president, and you have encouraged a square deal. World has grown so small such that it has almost grown that a government exists for the world. My question to you is, to what extent is owed to peoples that need a square deal in the role that we play in such a world?
Well, first of all, our duty is to take care of ourselves, to build a just and equal society here, in a society that's as grand as the Rocky Mountains and the great rivers and the great plains of the West. We don't have any particular duty to the rest of the world. I'm not against interventions when they're required. I'm the author of the Roosevelt Corollary to the Monroe Doctrine that says if we don't want Europeans to be meddling in South American and Central American affairs, we may have to do it ourselves from time to time. And so I understand that with our national greatness comes international responsibility. That's why I intervened in the Russo-Japanese War and several other situations in my time. I see that and I accept that. And the British Empire was beginning to fade. Nature abhors a vacuum. Some other nation had to step up, and that nation had to be us. We can't imagine the Spanish doing this, or the Germans, or the French. And so it was our responsibility to take this role, but we can't intervene in every struggle, and when we do, we had better have read many books about the history of that society before we bother to intervene, because if you do so badly, you can often make things worse. And one thing you said that really I want to combat slightly, and that is the idea of some sort of international entity that will guarantee the peace or help to secure it. Yes, I'm for that. I'm for a league of nations, perhaps, but never, under any circumstances, should we allow our national sovereignty to be compromised by any international organization whatsoever, period.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Really?
Yeah, no, I don't.
So the Hague was beginning to settle disputes between countries.
Sure.
And I'm all for that, because sometimes an arbitrator can help settle something that might otherwise have led to war or skirmishing. I'm all for that. But you never sacrifice your national sovereignty. There are times when you have to fight. And if the League of Nations says, oh no, you can't protect your southern flank from Mexican insurgents, I say no. We will cooperate to the extent that cooperation works, but our national sovereignty is an absolute, and nobody can tell the American people what to do, never, under any circumstances.
Yeah, I got that.
What part didn't you get?
You know, I here's what I'm doing, and I don't know if you're doing this too, and we won't be able to resolve this, but we've got an election coming up, and he'll say something and go, okay, I know, I've got it. And then he'll say something else, and it will go the other way. And I don't want to ask you too much, too specifically about the upcoming election, but I wonder whose vice president you would be, or which of the two candidates would be yours. I really wonder who he'd vote for, to be honest with you. But that's not fair to ask.
I won't intrude in that way, of course, but I will say this. I'm for women's suffrage. My senior thesis at Harvard was about women's rights, and I said in it, a woman should be enabled to do anything that a man can do if she can hack it. Now, We don't want women warriors in this country, and probably we don't want women lumberjacks. But if she can hack it, yes, and she should be paid equally with the man for those jobs. So I believe in that. And by the way, I received the first electoral vote ever cast by a woman in the 1912 Bull Moose campaign. So I'm not against a female president, let's put it that way. As to this other one, I mean no disrespect, and I know people, I know you too, you hear a little bombast, you hear a little heavy pronouncement, you hear a little knee-jerk reaction to the world, and you think, oh, look, parallel. Beware. I read a book a day all of my life. End of story. I wrote 37 books with my own hand. Ask yourself honestly, in the whole course of his life, how many books this Trump has read. You cannot be the president of this country unless you have done deep study of the world situation.
Yeah, but you also said...
Yes, deep study.
But you also said you need to be honest, and neither of them strike us as being sufficiently that.
Well, a plague on both their houses, then. You need a cowboy and a war hero and somebody who has done something with his life to stand up as a third party, and you need to crack that paradigm once and for all, so that when you get into this horrible situation where Tweedledee is no better than Tweedledum and you're going to hold your nose one way or t'other, there needs to be somebody else you can point to. The Constitution, which you so boldly have passed around to everyone in this room, does not anticipate a two-party system. The two-party system is just a habit, and it's a habit you should break.
Yeah, well... We'd love to do it, but you were the greatest, most loved, most viable third-party candidate ever, and you didn't get elected.
I got 27%.
I know. So you didn't get elected. Yes, sir, right over here, and then we'll work our way around.
Mr. President, could you comment on the National Park Service in general, and also then specifically about Theodore Roosevelt National Park, and that how you feel about that, and I don't think they allow hunting there.
The question was about national parks?
What was the first part of that question? I'm sorry.
Just comment generally about the National Park Service.
Yeah.
Ah, yes. Well, the National Park Service was created in 1916 after I had left the presidency. I was for the professionalization of our park rangers. Up till that time, we had an ad hoc system in which local forts and military bases would police Yosemite or police Yellowstone, and there was widespread poaching and all sorts of illegal mineral activity was going on in our parks. And so we needed to have a professional cadre of civil rangers who could police the parks, interpret them, protect their boundaries, and so on, know something about the game. So I was pushing for this, but it didn't come about until 1916. But it was based on suggestions from the Boone and Crockett Club and so on. I'll just quickly summarize my own work as a conservationist. Of this, I'm exceedingly proud. I realized when I became a national figure that we were destroying our resources. We were cutting too much timber. We were befouling rivers. We were opening mines without any thoughts for the future. We were using up land for agriculture and then just moving on and plowing new land. There was a great deal of soil erosion. There was overgrazing in the West and so on. And so this was really a very dangerous thing, that the frontier energies had been sometimes excessive and nobody had policed these resources. And so when I became president, there were 5 national parks. I didn't invent them. The first was Yellowstone in 1872. There were 5. I doubled that number to 10. I would have made it 20 or 25 or 30, but Congress would not go along with me. The Speaker of the House of Representatives, a man named Joseph Cannon of Ohio, said, and I quote, "Not 1 cent for scenery." not one cent for scenery, and so I had to work around him in Congress in almost everything that I did. So I doubled the number of parks from 5 to 10. I added 150 million acres to our national forest, tripling it in size, all by executive order. I invented the National Wildlife Refuge System. I wanted to protect penguins and egrets, and there was no way to do it, so I called in my Attorney General, Philander Knox, and I said, is there anything in our law books that allows the president to create a bird sanctuary? He said, no, I don't think that's ever been thought of. I said, let me ask a more interesting question. Is there any law that prevents the president from creating a bird sanctuary? There's your constitution. And he said, no, no such law exists. And I said, I do declare it. And I named the first 51 federal bird sanctuaries. You call them the National Wildlife Refuge System, one of the glories of the world. I signed the National Antiquities Act. The first of my 18 monuments was my beloved Devil's Tower, but there were many others. I would have gone farther there, too. You know, I wanted the Grand Canyon to be a national park. Congress wouldn't do it. The National Monuments and Antiquities Act really had contemplated small parcels of 5 or 10 acres. And so I said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to make the Grand Canyon a national monument, even though it's 828,000 acres. Congress protested, but they didn't undo it. And later that became a national park. In short, I set aside 230 million acres of our public domain as national park, national forest, national wildlife refuge. No president has done as much, ever. I was, of course, abused by the timber interests and the irrigation interests and the mining interests and the railroad interests and all of them. I remember, for example, that I had gone so far in the Pacific Northwest that a Oregon senator by the name of Charles Fulton put a rider in an agricultural appropriations bill, you know, the kind you have to sign, that prohibited me from naming any more national forests in 6 northwestern states. This would put an end to my capacity to create national forests. And it was one of those bills that the president just has to sign. We need a line item veto, but that's another question. But I know my Constitution better than Congress. And as you read this document, you'll see that there is a 10-day period between when a bill comes to the president's desk and when he must sign it or veto it. So I called in Gifford Pinchot, my forester, and said, let's get busy. And during those 10 days, we named 6 million new acres of national forest. These are known historically as the Midnight Forests. And in Oregon, we added a few 100,000 acres just to mess with this Senator Fulton. Yes. And he came in and he stood shaking like a leaf and livid and angry, and he could barely contain himself, and he said, I was a tyrant and a dictator and extra constitutional this and how dare I that. He said, what are you gonna do about it? I said, impeach me. And he slithered away. Yes.
This gentleman, I don't believe, has asked a question yet. Hi, go right ahead.
Hi, Mr. President. First off, thank you, because I wouldn't get any sleep without you, because my 3-year-old daughter simply cannot go to bed without her teddy. And you're the only reason that
right.
I get any
yeah.
rest at all. So I have to start with a thank you for that. My question would be, you mentioned being somewhat reluctant to intervene outside of the United States and
yes.
also being a proponent of conservation. Right now, there are a number of species globally that are in an immense amount of danger. You know, one that, you know, for me sentimentally is, you know, the black rhino. So I would wonder what your position would be on, would you take action? Would you... let things take their course. Would you intervene in a situation like that today?
Before you answer that, this will be our last question.
All right. Well, and it's a hard one, but let me say, you have this teddy bear here.
Mm-hmm.
This is not the size of the teddy bears of my time. What happened was that I refused to kill a bear, and Louisiana once in 1902, and this became the subject of a famous cartoon by Clifford Berryman, and then a toy manufacturer in Brooklyn wrote to me and said that he had a line of cloth animals, giraffes and rhinoceroses and so on, and he had a bear, and would they mind, or would I mind, if they called it the teddy bear? And I wrote back and said, be my guest, I don't think this fad will take off. And so that's the source of the teddy bear. I don't like to be called Teddy. Teddy is a boy's name. But it's also the name that my first wife called me, term of endearment. And it grates on me a little. But the country insisted upon calling me Teddy, and so that's that, I suppose. As to intervening in the world's arena to save the black rhinoceros or other endangered creatures, I think the bully pulpit is more important than intervention. In other words, the president may not have much power, but I said he has a very strong pulpit, a bully pulpit, and so I would use that, and I would turn to the richest among you, the hunters among you, and say, go to Africa, go to South America, go to Tibet and Mongolia and hunt and create associations like the Boone and Crockett Club that bring money for the preservation of these rare or nearly extinct animals, because hunters of means will do more to save these creatures than all of the government intervention that you can possibly imagine. And so I would say that this can be accomplished by devoted men and women of means who want those hunts to continue in perpetuity, to work closely with governments, but this is not something that rises to the desk of the President of the United States, except insofar as I would have, of course, used my bully pulpit. But within our own borders, of course, I will protect any creature. You know, we cannot skin this country. We know enough about evolution and about what would become ecology to know that forests are sponges for rivers, and that grizzly bears are a keystone species, and that the prairie dog matters because it helps to keep the balance of nature on our grasslands. We were just beginning to understand these things, just very in a cloud almost, but beginning to understand them. And I remember in 1918 being back in North Dakota, my last time there in Beach, North Dakota, out on the western edge of the Badlands. I said, you're overgrazing. You're going to destroy this paradise. You're overgrazing here. You have too many numbers on these grasses. And I was booed. For the first time in my life, I was booed, because the greed of the local grangers was greater than their ecological sense. Again, that's why we need government within the borders of the United States of America.
By the way, this has been an interesting conversation. We've talked a lot more about that sort of thing than we have in the past. But I cannot help but note that it does seem like a little bit of a contradiction. When you went to Africa after you were president and went on a years-long safari, Wikipedia says, but I'll defer to you on this, that you killed about 11,400 animals or trapped, and that six of them were albino rhinoceroses. Wow.
And so what's your point? Of course I killed them. I'm a hunter. I like to kill. I do like to kill animals. The hunt, sportsmanship, I remember killing my first grizzly bear in the Bighorn Mountains. It's one of the most thrilling moments of a person's life. Yes, I am unabashedly a hunter, and I do not apologize for it. But as I grew older, I did more photography than I did hunting with rifles. And in Africa, I knew that this would be an issue. I knew someone like you would have to bring this up. And so I worked with the Smithsonian and the American Museum of Natural History to bring them sets of these creatures for display. In other words, there was at least some scientific justification for all of this, and those displays were on the floors of the Smithsonian and the American Museum for decades. So yes, I'm not going to try to sneak away from your allegation. I like to hunt. I killed more than I needed to kill. I was thrilled to kill quadrupeds. I cannot satisfy you, a man who's never seen a rifle. And I don't intend to, but I do believe in responsible killing. Game butchery of any sort offends me. And if you go back to your Wikipedia or a more responsible encyclopedia, you will discover that the Boone and Crockett Club has done more for big game hunting in this country and the preservation of those quadrupeds than any other organization ever. And that that is my legacy, as well as the albino rhinoceros.
Fine.
Shame on you, sir.
Just trying to keep it real, Mr. President. So, Colonel Cowboy Roosevelt, last thought.
Well, I know we've gone at some length here. I'm just getting warmed up, but I see some weariness. I would stay all day here. I have much more to say. Nor do I understand why you are so reticent. I expected more from you. You haven't said many sentences.
No, I don't think they need me today.
Let me just say this. First of all, I love this country. I said in Dickinson, North Dakota, in 1886, like all Americans, I like big things. Big prairies and forests and mountains, big wheat fields and railroads and herds of cattle too, big steamships and factories and everything else. I like big things. The bigness of America. Nobody else has the Mississippi River. Nobody else has the Rocky Mountains, the Great Plains. Think of the majesty of this continent. How fortunate we are. No people has ever had a birthright like ours. But we must build a society that is equal to the greatness of this continent. We must be the most extraordinary civilization that ever existed on Earth. Only you can know if you've slipped. But you must always be a patriot for a civilization that is equal to the Grand Tetons and the Grand Canyon and the Great Redwoods. And I was out in California in 1903 on a round-the-country train trip, and I was going to give a speech at the Redwoods at Santa Clara. When I got there, they'd put placards on all the trees, you know, "Welcome Teddy" and "Bully" and "Hello, Mr. President." And I threw a fit. I said, "I'm not going to give my speech. I'm going to take a walk. When I come back from my hike, if those placards are gone, I might give my speech." They were shocked. They'd never seen anything like it. So I took my hike, and when I came back, of course, they'd pulled everything off the trees. They were all nervous. And I said, "These are our cathedrals. The Europeans have St. Peter's and Salisbury and Cologne and Notre Dame, but these are our cathedrals, the Grand Canyon, the Great Sequoias, the Redwoods, the mountains. And we must treat them with the same reverence and respect that they treat their fabulous churches. This is America. We're different from other nations. We have this magnificent and splendid backcountry, and we must protect it." You know, when I looked into the Grand Canyon for the first time, they wanted to build a hotel and a railroad spur right up to the edge of it. And I said, "No." And without any speechwriter, without thinking about it, I said, "Leave it as it is. The ages have been at work on it, and man can only mar it." Right? Leave it as it is. The ages have been at work on it, and man can only mar it. So don't compare me to this Trump just because I'm outspoken. Now, I want to close by this. I want you just to listen to this, because this is what made me who I am. You wonder why, what accounts for this? My father, my invalidism, my education, but mostly that excursion into Dakota, into the Badlands. I wrote 4 books about it, a trilogy. And then in my autobiography, there's a chapter called In Cowboy Land, which is my favorite. And the first passage of that I will now recite to you, because this is what made me who I am. I said, "It was still the Wild West in those days, the West of Owen Wister's novels and Frederick Remington's paintings and sculpture. We led a free and hardy life with horse and rifle. We worked under the scorching midsummer sun when the wide plains wavered and shimmered in the heat. And we knew the freezing misery of riding night guard around the cattle during the late fall roundup. In the soft springtime, the stars shone glorious in our eyes each night before we fell asleep. And in the winter, we rode through blinding blizzards in which the driven snow dust burnt our faces. There were, to be sure, monotonous times when we walked the beef herds and trail cattle hour after hour at the slowest of paces. But minutes and hours teeming with excitement as we stopped stampedes or drove the herds through rivers treacherous with quicksand or brimmed with running ice. We knew toil and hardship and hunger and thirst. And we saw men die as they worked amongst the horses and cattle or fought in evil feuds with one another. But for all of this, we felt the beat of hardy life in our veins, and ours was the glory of work and the joy of living. Thank you very much.
Teddy Roosevelt.
Hey, by Godfrey. Hey, I love this country. John Williams. Yes, by Godfrey. We love this country.
We have 2 minutes before noon. We will be out in the lobby signing your programs and...
John, may I just take off this mustache, which was falling off anyway, and just say, don't you love John Williams? I want to tell you about the Theodore Roosevelt National Library in Western North Dakota and so much more. We'll do it in the lobby, but listen to John Williams. I get to travel all over the United States doing this, and there's one and only one person I work with, and it's John Williams. So thank you, my dear friend.
And remember that the video of this, you can share it with your friends, will be at WGNradio.com. In a few days, they need to edit it and take out my part, and then...
what's left of it. And, I apologize.
So you can see it and share it there. I'm so glad you're here. Thanks for being part of our show. And we'll see you next time. November. We're doing Jefferson
by
in November.
Godfrey, November.
Yeah.